the mulch resistant against the, you know, Formosan termites survive and has habitat, whatever the traditional, you know, nutrition point with. And so we consider that, you know, use that, you know, select a different mulch type, like here is six different mulch type as our substrate. And then we try to use, employ that, you know, mechanism as a biological control agent, treat all the different, you know, mulch and use a seed. Soak that, you know, the mulch substrate in a different, you know, concentration of the Canadian. After that, we set up the two, the one apparatus that have the left side and the right side is one is the control, one is treatment, and the center side of a release chamber, you know, 100 termites, foragers with the soldiers, and releasing the center chamber. And as we look at, you know, different times, how termites forage, the number in different, you know, chambers, and we record that, you know, what is going on. And you can see some termites, you know, feeding on the different types of mulch, just like an example here. And let's check out the result, you know, for the termite foraging behavior. You can see this chart is represented different, you know, first phase is by hour, second phase by day. And you can see the, you know, little bit of change, you know, with the different, you know, mulch type and substrate. And but overall say, you can see that, you know, the living foragers as a proportion forage on the mulch be treated by the mechanism is kind of low. It's a, you know, 20% or something like that. Yeah. So whatever that seems might be, tell you some repellency in there. And if you check that, you know, different, you know, variety of the mulch substrate, you can see some significant difference presented there. That, you know, some is a little bit attracted, you know, termites as a favorite to the food substrate. Some is down, you know, but I always say it's you know, lower than, you know, 8% of the total, you know, foragers, foragers on that, you know, much be treated by mechanism. Let's check out the termite mortality. You know, termites will be easily attacked by this, you know, mechanism. That's the early stage left, this, you know, cadavers, you know, foragers. The right side is a later stage, and eventually there grew up a lot of the, you know, Canadian spores generated from their surface or body. Well, that is, let's check that, you know, statistically a little bit analysis. As a mulch, you know, factor is very significant, and the dose is too. And the day also significant, along with the time, is more and more termites be added to the mortality, added to the you know, the data of the day, you know, termites. And let's check the different data. So for example, it's 7 days after, you know, termites released to the apparatus, so we test it. And you can see that along with the, you know, concentration we apply, the mortality goes high. And the variety of the mulches is a little bit different. And as we go next, you know, this final days, well, 20 days after release, we can check this, you know, graph out there with the mortality. And significant, you know, the mortality, you know, like the 10/5 of this concentration. And obviously, you know, termites is susceptible to this, you know, biological agent. Well, we are check out the only the termites cadaver. That's the dietary reason it came from this, you know, fungal control agent. So that is the kind of thing. Along with the concentration growth, that over the 10/5 is significant, more than 65 of the average of the total termites, you know, died from the metaries. You know, it's go with 10^6 is you know, almost 80% over. So that's obviously, you know, that, you know, use that, you know, over 10^6 this concentration, and treated the mulch substrate were significantly, you know, killed the any foragers over there. So mulch consumption, we check the termites how they eat that. And we have the left side chamber and the right side chamber. One is, you know, served to control, one is served to the chamber, the treatment chamber. So termites have the options on which one they like to eat most, you know. So that you can see that by the, you know, different concentration of the mechanism we applying it onto the mulch substrate, and you can see significant difference, you know, in the control chamber and the treatment chamber. Yeah, so that means, you know, along with the concentration increase, that is the consumption rate is decreased. Well, if we can build the one relative index used numerator as a food consumption in the treatment chamber and a food consumption in the control chamber as a denominator, we can see a relative of this, you know, comparison of this, you know, control chamber and the treatment chamber, and what is the most saturated their prefer. If they're equal to 1, that's in the index, that means that's equal almost. There's no significant preference between that control and the treatment. So that, you know, so if less 1, that's a significant less of the food consumption in treatment chamber. So you can see that with the different concentration we apply, so that's a significant reduce of this index of the thermized food consumption. And this is by that different variety of the mulches that have no significant difference. But overall say there's a lower than just a 0.5% of the food be consumed by in the treatment chamber. Well, some important finding in this research, and foragers were significantly repelled by this fungal treated mulch substrate. And pretty much just less 20% of the foragers can check it out in that treated mulch. And the second is after that, almost 4 weeks later, is 99% of the termites be killed by this treated fungus substrate. And the third one is a 34 to 71% in the reduction of the food consumption when you treated the mulch. And the fourth one is a result indicates that repellence and virulence of the mechanism could potentially reduce the suitability of these treated mulches as a habitat for Formosan termite. Another one is I think the soil-borne nature of this mechanism, the fungal agent, could be potentially applied to the mulch as a soil-borne, so they can just their initial home, so they can persist in this as a long while. So last one, I tried to talk about a little bit this use of as a cultural control. In the future, we can develop use this biologically based cultural control, create an undesirable environment for the Formosan termites to prevent the future spreading, local spreading, even the long distance spreading. So much substrate treated with pathogenic fungi like this mechanism is an undesirable environment we create. That means we can have that potentially biological-based cultural control, this technology in the future available. So thank you.
And then Mark Parsons is going to talk about IPM implementation from a state and local perspective. Now, a few weeks back, Mike Fitzner planted a seed, and he asked me if I would consider getting involved with taking the lead, our agency's lead, in strengthening the partnership between CSRES, NRCS, and the Land Grant University System. So we held a meeting, and the more I got into the discussion, the more it seemed that maybe there might be some structural elements of the National Invasive Species Management Plan that could be applied to NRCS conservation programs. And coming from a systems analysis background from Berkeley, I thought, we need a model. So I met with NRCS National Program Leader, technical staff, and a few of my CSRES colleagues to discuss the model. Here's a little bit about the program structure for the National Invasive Species Management Plan. Now they have, the National Invasive Species Council. So this all arose out of the executive order on invasive species that came out in February 1999. Established the National Invasive Species Council, co-chaired by the Secretaries of Commerce, Ag, and Interior, also comprised of the Secretaries of State, Treasury, Defense, Transportation, and Administrators for EPA and USAID, and more recently, Department of Homeland Security and NASA. They also authorized the formation of an advisory committee called the Invasive Species Advisory Committee. Now, this is all made up of federal agencies, and these are all non-federal folks with a wide array of interests represented at the table, from the pet industry to aquaculture to you name it, all kinds of research, education interests, and beyond.
How do you make money uneasy for the next sector? What do they
know? What's that? I'm not sure. The National Invasive Species Management Plan originally had 57 action items, and these are being reprioritized. But they had have a whole bunch of subcommittees, and so we can think about maybe an analogous model that we could use in addressing conservation programs and IPM implementation. So some of their summit committees include leadership and coordination, prevention, early detection and rapid response, control and management, restoration, international cooperation, research information management, education and public awareness. Now, we all share a common theme here, and that greater implementation of IPM will help all of us advance conservation and natural resource goals. And I thought maybe some of the key elements might be a balanced exchange of issues, information, and knowledge. Certainly more training would help in IPM implementation, better coordination at the county, state, and national levels, grow awareness of relevant conservation programs and IPM adoption, and then evaluation of impacts and outcomes. In a more conceptual form, here's our balanced exchange of issues, information, and knowledge, maybe some subcommittees, and the subcommittees for the National Invasive Species Management Plan are made up of a co-chair, two co-chairs, one that's from a federal agency and another co-chair that's a non-federal agency person, so NGOs or non-government organization person. Okay, we have the NRCS, CSRES interface, we have federal coordination, and two types of training at these giant conference centers. I know some of the NRCS staff have recommended that they maintain some degree of on-site training for site-specific development of conservation plans with different scenarios. We'd have another type of training called distance training that's web-based. And then certainly evaluation scheme to evaluate it all. Now I think we should all strive to make things as less complicated as possible. And remember, this is one of my classic, one of these classic old Rube Goldberg models of his mustache wiper. So I hope to not make things more complicated than need be. So I propose the conceptual model. Okay, sorry about that. Sorry about that. So here's the IPM Advisory Committee. I'll just go through the elements here. Now this would be the non-Fed entity. We'd have subcommittees that would address gaps in education, control and management, maybe extension, green payments, research. We need maybe a sociologist to help us implement IPM programs. We might even need a psychologist if we have Mike involved here. Okay. Okay. Then we need federal coordination, so we have the Federal IPM Coordinating Committee. This is made up of all federal agencies. We have the NRCS, CSRES interface. We have two types of IPM training, again on-site for conservation plan scenarios, distance delivered through the IPM Training Consortium, and I'll talk more specifically about this in a moment, and then some evaluation scheme to evaluate impacts and outcomes. And believe it or not, there's already a big push to develop logic models. I don't know if all of you are familiar with logic models, but it's a big thing in the federal government these days to develop a logic model of everything so that we have performance-based measures and short-term, intermediate, and long-term inputs and outputs and outcomes and impacts. So those are all very critical. Now, how would this IPM Advisory Committee work? Well, what I would propose is that individuals, let's just go around the ring here. These are some of the entities that might reside on this committee. Maybe some representatives of pest control advisors and certified crop advisors, North American independent crop consultants, rangeland IPM, invasive species advisory committee member, cropland IPM, professional societies, entomology, plant pathology, weed science, agronomy, industry, Cattlemen's Association, IPM nonprofits, tree fruit IPM from the West, North Central, and Eastern, a sociologist, IPM centers, including the Western, North Central, Northeast, and Southern region, maybe some of the environmental groups, the Nature Conservancy, Natural Resource Defense Council, Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, and others. So this is just a number of them, and obviously we need a number of other different entities to serve on this. I didn't want to make it any more complicated than it is. Okay? Okay, how would they make it on this committee? Well, these are all, again, non-federal entities. So I would recommend that we have an application system. So if somebody wants to serve on this committee, they submit an application to the Federal IPM Coordinating Committee, and it's reviewed, and if you have appropriate credentials to represent your constituency, then you can reside on this committee. Now, the advantage of having a system like this is NRCS has a lot of folks that are interested in their conservation programs that are trying to encourage the agency in moving in one direction versus another without a lot of coordination. And so by having a system like this, any information that's discussed and exchanged and issues that are raised and knowledge that is exchanged goes forward by consensus, not by the process of who's the vocal minority. Okay? And this would keep it cricket with FACA. This would be a FACA compliant committee. And the FACA is the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And the reason that it was put together was to make sure that no group in particular could get an advantage over another group in advising the government in a way that would benefit their own special interests. So in this way, it would be collective thinking and advising the government by consensus. And I think it's a much better way to do it. Okay? Then we'd have our NRCS, CSRES interface here, IPM training on-site, an IPM training consortium that could service the state technical committees to make sure they're all aware of the principles of integrated pest management. The extension IPM coordinators could serve as a system for training the trainers. And certainly IPM training could be provided to NRCS staff, county agents and specialists, soil and water conservation district staff, and perhaps the technical service providers. Now, just a few remarks about distance-delivered training. That seems to be a big topic these days. I've been involved for the last few years with my co-chair, Mark Aserno, who's in the second row here from University of Minnesota, and then a whole bunch of other colleagues from other universities as well as some federal agencies in developing the IPM Cube Training Consortium. And this is a three-tiered training program for IPM that consists of the first tier, the core IPM Cube module, pest biology elements, and then the third tier are specialty topics. Now, the core IPM module includes basic concepts about IPM and IPM implementation. It would include 12 to 18 hours of instruction, and it would be a prerequisite for any pest management certificate. This would get everybody on the same page as far as the principles of integrated pest management. The next tier deals with pest biology modules, and these would include things like entomology, plant pathology, weed science, and vertebrates. 6 hours of instruction would be required per topic, and at least one module would be required for a certificate. The third tier would include specialty modules, and these might include structural, landscape and turf, invasive species, rangeland weeds, commodity-specific IPM, weeds of natural areas, and special needs, like for museums and historical buildings. Now, some of the